Welcome to the Life in the Stocks podcast, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Matt Stocks. I'm the host, and the show features unedited, in-depth, candid conversations with a wide range of musicians, actors, comedians, and creatives. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to Life in the Stocks on your favorite podcast platform. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and indeed all major podcast platforms. Be sure to give me a follow on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as well, at Matt Stocks DJ. That way you can keep up to date with all of my live Q&A dates, my DJ performances, and of course, who's coming up on the show as well. But without further ado, let's crack on with the show, shall we? Here we go.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I've been listening to a few of your previous podcast appearances in the lead up to this conversation, and I don't know how I hadn't noticed this before, but you have this lovely interchangeable accent that sounds, you know, quite American sometimes and then like really, really British at other moments. And it kind of, it's just different words hops back and forth.
Right.
I love it. It's a very,
so it kind of depends on who I'm talking to, right? So it's like,
I get it.
Yeah. So like if I'm, you know, see, it might start to kind of creep out a little bit right now. It's like, oh dear.
By the end of this interview, you'll be like, well, I'm off for tea now.
Yeah. Well, I did just have some toast and Marmite.
Keeping the scene alive over there.
That's right. That's right.
And when do you come here?
What, to England?
Yeah. You mentioned you're coming over to see your dad, or has that happened already?
No, I'm coming in October. I mean, well, it's October already, in about 2 weeks.
Right, yeah. On. And you're around for a while, or is it like a brief, fleeting in and out visit?
It'll be about 2 weeks, I think. Yeah. Ah.
Well, I'm around all of that month on tour.
Cool.
I'm sure there'll be some shows, if not in Cambridge, then definitely near. Are you going to be in Cambridge, or are you going to be in London?
No, I'll be in London most of the time. I actually might go to Cambridge for the weekend because my older brother lives there still. And that's where I grew up. But my dad has been in London pretty much the whole time. So,
well, I want to get into the story of all of that stuff.
Very
quickly, I remember briefly meeting your dad at Download Festival in 2014. And he was on the stage.
It would have been 2016 or 17, right? Because I joined the band in 2016.
Then it would have been 17 because 17, it was the year I broke up with my ex, and she was like an agent, and she had one of those funky passes that gets you everywhere. And she'd left the festival and she'd given me hers. And she was like, look, I know NoFX is your favorite band ever. And I know that you want to go and speak to them and say hello. So I'm going to give you my pass. And it had her name on it. She's like, but whatever you do, don't misbehave. And I was on my best behavior, but yeah, I went and watched the show on the stage.
Yeah, I remember that.
Your dad was there, and I turned around. Do you know Ian Richards? Have you met Ian? He promotes a lot of like NoFX shows in the UK.
Yeah,
big guy,
yeah,
bald head, glasses.
Yeah, Yeah.
So Ian was on stage with me, and I pointed at your dad and I said,
like, who the hell is that madman?
No, I said, is that Melvin's dad?
Yeah, exactly.
Because he kind of looks like an older Melvin. And he was like, oh, I don't know, actually. And it turned out it was yours.
Yeah. So, longest dreadlocks in the UK, maybe.
Apart from maybe Don Letts, I reckon your dad is second. So is your mum and dad both British?
No, both of them are actually Czech, in the Czech Republic.
The plot thickens.
Yeah, or well, was called the Czech Republic. As I think you can still call it that, because I don't like calling it Chechia. It's weird. But they are both Czech and moved to England in 1968 when the Russians kind of invaded and reinvaded to escape, you know, being basically, you know, behind the Berlin Wall, essentially. And moved to London and then met in London. So they didn't know each other in the Czech Republic.
Oh, wow. Okay. So they were both from the Czech Republic, but they didn't know each other there. They only met when they made it over this side.
Yeah. Around, you know, among some other Czech friends. And then they met there and had me and my brother. And my dad was going to, he was studying nuclear physics in Cambridge. So
wow.
So we moved to Cambridge, and then they split up essentially pretty soon after me and my younger brother were born. We're just about a year apart, 13 months apart. And so then he moved back to London. So I've been, and then I grew up in Cambridge until I was 12.
And that's with your mum?
With my mum, but seeing my dad a lot and going to London a lot. And my dad's quite a sort of, you know, eccentric character and person.
I mean, I saw that when I met him. Lord only knows what he would have been like in the swinging 60s, escaping communism and discovering Carnaby Street and all of that wonderful stuff.
Not so much into that scene. He's a super, you know, very politically active and huge punk fan, actually. Kind of, you know, he used to do a lot of pogoing in his room to Anarchy in the UK, and huge Sex Pistols fan. He's actually in there's some YouTube footage of when they did some reunion and he's in the front, like, ugh, you know. So that's pretty cute. But not so much, I mean, not like a Rasta or anything, just the dreadlocks are sort of deceiving in that sense. It's sort of more like, you know, a bit of an anarchist and
a rebel.
There you go. That'll be a nice way to say it.
So you grew up surrounded by kind of British punk and two-tone and all of that good stuff. Was that very much the soundtrack to your childhood?
Absolutely, yeah, that's kind of where it started.
You're way more legit than your American counterparts then.
Hell yeah. I know. I didn't even understand the American punk scene very much. I sort of thought it was a bit
try hard, go on, you can say it.
Well, a little bit white bread, you know. So like, what is this all these like happy Californians talking about, you know, I don't know, love and stuff. Like it felt very, when I first moved, it felt a bit strange. I didn't really understand kind of where that energy was coming from, because it felt very sort of relaxed and easy in California compared to, you know, England in the 80s and Thatcherism and how difficult it actually was, you know, and that was kind of what I grew up around. So, you know, pretty depressive times, and then depressing just financially. And, you know, I mean, I used to help my dad break into squats for people, and we, you know, we were living in the East End and in Brixton. And so it was sort of, you know, that felt very much like that's what working class punk rock is, right? And ska and rocksteady scene. And so moving to California was kind of a bit of a shock, but I actually ended up living really close to Gilman Street, which is...
Well, how old are you, sorry, when you moved to the States? How old are you?
12. Yeah.
So you had a full childhood in England and definitely like enough experiences here to, I guess, form your worldviews and kind of opinions about certain things. So very quickly, before we get to America, would you say, looking back, was the childhood like happy? Was it exciting? Was it challenging? Was it all of the above? What was the UK first 12-year period of your life like, looking back now?
I actually had a really nice, I would say, a happy childhood. I had, you know, it wasn't easy in some ways, but you know, we didn't have money, but that doesn't matter to me. I think if you have good sort of people around you, that doesn't matter at all. And my mom's quite eccentric also. We did a lot of traveling. We lived in kind of all through Europe. We did a lot of, my mom was sort of just kind of the idea of being a kind of housewife of, you know, taking care of. I have an older brother also who's a punk rocker and a skinhead and stuff and a mod. So we were all kind of, you know, the three of us in the house. And she sort of said, I don't want to be a bored English housewife. So we rented out our council house and she bought a van and put beds in the back. And we traveled all the way through Europe when I was 7 and my brother was 6. And my mom was a clown and we would play street theater in every little town we would get to.
Wow.
So she's kind of a wild woman too. And
that's amazing.
And then we lived in India for a while. We lived in Greece. So my English childhood was very kind of sweet and idyllic and you know, lovely. I feel like I had a good childhood. I mean, there was lots of difficult things around. And I mean, the street I lived on was really crazy, all that kind of stuff. We, you know, definitely had some time in around a lot of violence and not personally in our family so much. But, you know, it was a wild time. The 80s were depressing and difficult and England was going through a lot. So all of that was very, I was very aware of that. You know, I was very concerned about, you know, nuclear war and things like that, the things that you worry about as a kid, you know. So, but most of all, I was pretty good and sweet childhood, I would say.
It sounds, I know you can sometimes put the rose tinted specs on, but it sounds like a life of adventure. And I think as a young person, if you're exposed early on to as many different cultures as you were, it puts you in such a good position, I think, to be a good, fully formed, fully rounded adult, and somebody who sees the world as it is, which is this kind of beautifully diverse, you know, rich tapestry of all different strokes of folks.
Absolutely.
Which not everybody has, you know. A lot of people lead quite sheltered backgrounds up to a certain age. Like, to be that travel savvy before you've even hit your teenage years and moved to America. Was that still mind-blowing when you landed in the West Coast of America as a teen, even though you'd seen so much, to being kind of like that classic 80s high school movie clicks in the cafeteria kind of scenario? That must have seemed like almost like the opposite to you, what your upbringing had led you to believe, which is like everybody is equal and kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I think that we had lived in so many different places and I had seen a lot, but I hadn't experienced. Yeah, the West Coast, you know, U.S., Californian kind of schooling system was so strange. And people, I mean, I had major culture shock and I had lived in third world countries. So it was definitely... sort of a period of adjusting, and especially as a teenager. It wasn't quite so clicky as you see in the films because it was California and it wasn't, but I did actually live in Alaska for a little while and that did feel like the films, you know, like that was sort of like, you know, you could, you know, there was like cheerleaders and all this kind of weird stuff, which, you know, coming from England is so just strange and foreign and American in it. So I got a little, you know, I went to roller skating rinks and like first dances and all this kind of strange, like, you know, in England, no one touched each other at that point at all. Like you didn't hug at all. You didn't even do a quick hug at the end of a goodbye or something. So, you know, you move to the States and suddenly everyone sort of like puts their arms around you and does a first, you know, the first dance. And it's like so awkward and you're a teenager. It's weird. Just a very, felt very different.
Did you slot in okay?
It was hard for a while. You know, I that's why I think I attached myself to, you know, back into this kind of ska and punk scene, because I just didn't relate to what they were listening to or what the, you know, everybody was into Duran Duran and stupid, weird shit like that, that I just was like, fuck that, you know, let's, so I found my sort of niche of people, which were like the punk rockers and the skaters and the, you know, new wave kids and that kind of thing. So that's sort of where, you know, you did find a small group of people that were into that and continued on, you know, being around them and making those kinds of friendships.
And that was the Gilman scene, as you mentioned earlier on, which for those who don't know is, you know, that kind of fertile period in West Coast punk and ska, where it was kind of Green Day and Operation Ivy. And who else would have been around at that time that would be known now?
I mean, a lot of bands went through there, you know, Bouncing Souls, AFI were starting up when Dancehall Crashers was sort of getting started. And I mean, kind of everybody went through there. Fishbone, of course, played there, Hepcat.
But it was basically Green Day's like clubhouse, right?
Yeah, I mean, they lived a little further out. They lived in Pinole. So, but, you know, they kind of claim that they're from kind of the Berkeley area because they moved closer to Gilman at that point. But yeah, I mean, it was definitely Operation Ivy was, and Rancid. I mean, the first Rancid shows were probably there, I would assume. Screw 32, a lot of small East Bay punk bands, but everybody that was on tour, I mean, it's still going on. The Gilman Street Project is still happening, which is phenomenal. You know, it's still got that nice kind of DIY community feel to it. That is what it is. So yeah, I mean, everybody played there. You know, everybody.
Was it like the West Coast CBGB? Did it have that similar
exactly.
kind? Yeah.
Very much so. Except that it wasn't a bar. It's all ages.
Right.
The CBGBs is a bar, and this is all ages, and that's what's made it so special, because it was one of the only places you could go. So.
How old were you when you first started going there? Was it like immediate 13, 14, or a little bit later?
No, probably 16, 15, 16, because we moved around quite a bit at the beginning of moving to the States. So I probably went there about 15, and my brother was a year younger than me, and he was going there a bit more than I was, so about 15, 16, yeah.
And did you see super early shows by Green Day and Operation Ivy?
I saw Operation Ivy, and I saw, Skanking Pickle, Hepcat.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a bunch of those kinds of bands. So, I saw Green Day somewhere else earlier. I think it was Sproul Plaza or something like that, which was in Berkeley, California, like the UC Berkeley campus. There was a lot of shows there as well. So, and a lot of ska shows. And yeah, it was quite a scene, and it still is. But, you know, and then we used to have Dance Craze every Saturday night at midnight at the UC Theater. Movie theater that was, they would play Dance Craze and Rocky Horror Picture Show. So that was kind of another little area you could go at midnight. I think it was at midnight that on Saturday nights, it was where all the sort of young people went because we couldn't get into bars, you know. Because in England, you can go to the pub, but you can't here until you're 21.
No.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's
it
probably
makes
why
no
we...
sense. You can, yeah.
I was going to say, it's probably why we've got a nation of binge drinkers in the UK. It's because it's encouraged from such a young age. It's like, wee!
But it makes no sense. You can drive when you're 16. You can vote and go to the army by 18. But you can't drink until you're 21. Ridiculous. Yeah.
Nuts. Absolutely nuts. So, was it... You know, was Tim and Matt from Rancid, were they in an early incarnation of your old mm-hmm. band? Am I right mm-hmm. in thinking this was the case? That's interesting. So they, what, had finished Operation Ivy and this was before Rancid that they started that group and then left to do Rancid? Or what happened?
I believe it was about the same. They were ending Operation Ivy and they started Dancehall Crashers as a sort of side ska project. So it was supposed to be more of a ska band then, you know, what was becoming Rancid, and Operation Ivy was kind of a bit more punk, but Dancehall Crashers was supposed to be a bit more of a trad ska kind of thing. So they started the band, but with, you know, a different group of people. I think Jason, our guitar player, was also in a band called Downfall with Tim Armstrong, which was a bit more punky, and they put some music out. And then sort of at one point Tim left and Matt left, and whoever was still there, which was a guy called Joel Wing on bass, Eric Larson on drums, Ingrid was the other singer. Then Elise joined, and then this lady Ingrid left, and they were looking for another singer, which is when I came along. But in the meantime, there were a lot of other band members that kind of came in and out. We had three horn players, and we would have two horn players, and we have a keyboard player. Then we didn't have a keyboard player. We had two guitar players. Jamie McCormick is a brilliant guitar player, who's on a bunch of our early recordings, and he's a lovely guy that we're all still friends with. He was in the band. I think we've probably got the most rotating band members of any East Bay band at that time. It was ridiculous.
You say it sounds like Kiss.
It was crazy. Somebody was going to do a family tree about the dancehall crash or the East Bay punk scene, because everybody was sort of going in and out.
Do you know what though? I spoke to Chris from Less Than Jake about this, and apart from Less Than Jake, it seems like every 90s American ska band has had about 1,000 members. Like, none of them can stay together. I don't know what it is. Less Than Jake kind of always been the same guys, apart from Vinny more recently. But that's it. That's the only change they've had in their lineup in nearly 30 years. Whereas every other ska band, it's like, who's with them this week?
Yeah, exactly.
I guess that's the territory you get into when there's like more than four members, because it's hard enough keeping four people together, right? But when there's like seven, eight, then that's a nightmare.
Absolutely. And, you know, another reason that we eventually kind of dropped having, you know, the horns, and we get a lot of shit for that, but it's like, you can't tour with nine band members, you know, not if you're not making any money.
Yeah.
And so we had two singers already. We had two guitar players. Like, at that point, like, we've so much, you know, harmony happening already, and, you know, double guitar lines or, you know, back and forth vocals, that do we really need three horns on top of that? It's like, we're writing the songs anyway. Like,
who gives you shit for not having horns? That seems like a strange thing to pick a hole in.
The American ska scene is very attached to three horns, and they sort of seem, or at least two, they seem to think that you're not a ska band,
right,
if you don't have that.
They're purists, ska purists is what they are.
They're purists, but, you know, it's like,
but it's not pure ska, it's third wave.
Well, the whole thing is ridiculous because,
yeah, right,
you know, you also get, you know, at that time there was a window of time that if you signed to a major label, you were getting called a sellout. Mm. However, all of our favorite ska bands and, you know, the Specials and Madness, they were all, you know, maybe they only had one horn player, or they were on major labels, or et cetera, et cetera. So the whole thing was ridiculous. It was sort of like this American, I don't know, way of feeling like they were holding on to something. It's like, well, why don't you care about something that matters, like racism or something like that?
Yeah. Social issues.
Instead of like whether or not, you know, it's like, there's a reason you get to hear this album, is because it was released on a, you know, an actual distributing, you know, label which in the early 90s, that was just before CDs kind of started to take off and you could make your own CDs more easily. And independent labels were able to kind of push that music out there. You know, it was still hard to get distribution anywhere. So, you know, major labels or major distribution was a big deal. It's a great thing to have.
And from a UK perspective, and I feel really bad, so I'm just going to come clean and I'm going to be honest. The dancehall crashers were not especially known over here, and still aren't really. Like, one thing I like to do in the lead up to any of these conversations is go through the guest's body of work and try and like absorb and consume as much of it as possible before the conversation. And that's one of my favorite parts of the process. And I went in on the whole Dancehall Crashers back catalog and was like, I don't really know any of this stuff. And I've been DJing at ska festivals and shows for years and years and years, and I thought I had pretty much everything on lock. And so I guess the first thing is, like, do you feel like the band broke up before you were able to make waves over here? Or was it just that you weren't one of those bands that had perhaps, say, like a game soundtrack song placement? Because, you know, the only like Real Big Fish, Goldfinger, Less Than Jake, all massive over here. But even like a Boss Tones, not so big in the UK. Obviously, impression that I get, everybody sort of knows that song. But beyond that, in the UK, everybody's a bit like, Boston's not really sure. So there's certain, and certainly bands like Hepcat, you know, again, didn't make it over here. Like, so there's only a few, but I don't really know where I'm going with this, Karina. I guess I was trying to say that I've recently discovered your music and I love it. And I'm grateful that I now have it in my life and can spin it in my DJ sets. But yeah, I feel like I've been missing out for a long time.
Well, I think there's quite a few things, you know, like the kinds of labels that you were on as a band, like whether or not you got good distribution and good promotion in Europe was kind of random. So we were on a label that was called Moonscar initially from Chicago, which was the Toasters label. And they did a fair amount of distribution and, you know, in the States and were locked into the ska scene. So there was kind of some following, you know, and in the States. Then we signed to a label called 510, which was an East Bay label run by Green Day's managers. And they started this label 510 that was attached to a subsidiary kind of essentially, or a partnership with MCA. So even though we were kind of attached to them, feeling like we were on kind of an independent, they were distributed and working with MCA. Now, MCA was a shit label when it came to, you know, we were on Universal internationally, but we didn't have the same sort of, you know, promotion and that kind of stuff in Europe as some other bands did. Now, Less Than Jake, you know, Real Big Fish, people like that in the 90s, they got a lot of kind of push, not only in Europe, but on radio play here. And it was just a different, they really kind of were able to pick that up and take that into a certain place. But, you know, so that's part of the reason that certain bands did well in Europe or not, like you'd get better distribution or not. I mean, we played the Reading Festival, we played European Warped Tour, Kerrang wrote about us. We had some good stuff going on in the UK and in Europe, but it was not as big, and we didn't do crazy tours like, you know, Less Than Jake and those guys. They tour for like 2 months at a time. I mean, yeah, we would do 3 weeks and come back, and we didn't do like these 12-week tours and stuff like that. So there was a few reasons, you know. We were huge, but we were together for 18 years. So it wasn't just that we didn't spend the time to do it. We were together for a long time. We were together way before Less Than Jake and Real Big Fish were ever bands, you know?
Mm.
So before Hepcat was a band, we started right before Hepcat even became a band. So we have the history, but we just also went our own path a little bit. We also didn't play all the big super duper trad ska kind of third wave, you know, festivals. We were conscious about keeping our music a little bit out of getting pigeonholed into that third wave ska thing too much.
Is that because you felt like it was going to be a flash in the pan, which in some ways it obviously was?
Yeah, but some ways it wasn't, apparently, because they're so good. But yeah, no, we did we were concerned about that, you know. Yes. And we didn't. And those are the kinds of kids that were, you know, concerned about the sellout issues and all, and that you weren't a real ska band if you didn't have three horn players and all that kind of stuff. We were playing with NOFX a lot. We toured with Bad Religion. I mean, we toured with the Boston's and Bouncing Souls and H2O early on, and Hepcat and Chris Murray when he was in King Apparatus. And so we had a big ska kind of, you know, scene, but we also were associating and playing with on Warped Tour with, you know, like I said, NOFX and other bands. So we kind of wanted to be able to you know, promote ourselves or be ourselves in kind of the punk scene as well. Like, definitely we're pop punk, we're not hardcore, of course, but with two guitars and no horns, we felt like we fit into the skater punk scene, snowboard skater punk scene that was Californian specific quite well. And that was where we, you know, we had a lot of friends in that scene. So, I mean, you know, Blink and No Doubt and AFI, all those bands opened for us.
I mean, there's some amazing songs. There's some amazing songs. And like the two kind of dual lead vocal attack is really exciting and I think distinct from a lot of the stuff that was happening at that point in time. I wish I could have seen you live back in that era, because I bet you had a very high energy, kind of high impact, you know, exciting, fun live show.
Yeah, that's what we were known for. That's kind of our thing. I don't think our records ever really captured that at all. It was all about the live show. Yeah. So, I mean, we have a live DVD out that has, you can see a little bit of that, but I think that's really where we shined, was our live shows were exciting and fun and really just a lot of high energy. I was running around like a mad woman. Can't do that anymore.
are you still give it a good go? I've seen you do your thing
a little bit.
So do you have fond memories of the scene back then? I don't want to linger too long on this if you don't want to, but you know, I feel like the more things have kind of come to light in recent years, seems like it wasn't always the best of places to inhabit as a woman, the music industry. Did you have negative experiences that did deter you from wanting to like keep the band together and stay in it, or was for the large part your experience of the music industry fairly positive with the bands you would come into contact with and, you know, the kind of touring crews you'd be around and all of that stuff?
For the most part, as two women in a band, with, you know, mostly men that we were touring with, we had very positive experiences. The bands were not generally the issue. I know that's been a thing lately for a couple of people that have talked about some difficult situations and terrible situations. But, you know, I've always been pretty bold and very aware of my kind of surroundings, and the same with Elise, the other singer, and she also was our manager. So we're pretty tough ladies, and we're not going to be fucked with, and we would not put ourselves in situations that were concerning. I mean, I'm not saying that somebody should be at fault for that, but I'm just saying, as far as my experience, I was always very aware of that and kind of had my fists up, you know, ready for any issues. So that, in that way, we had lots of very positive experiences with all the bands that we toured with. That wasn't an issue ever. You know, did we see some stuff a couple times that were really concerning? I have a few experiences of things that I saw that were really worrying to me. But they were like by security guards or by, you know, a lot of sexism, you know, with, you know, kind of the people that were essentially kind of gatekeepers, you know, like promoters and fans even, and although they're not really gatekeepers, but you know, there was a lot of, you know, we toured with Bad Religion, for example, and that was really difficult because we would get certain cities. For example, we played in Italy one time with actually NOFX and Buzzcocks were on that bill, and we just had so many things thrown at us, that batteries, bottles, mud. Being women in a kind of male dominated scene was definitely difficult. And I did write a lot of songs that were kind of feminist based, you know, lyrically, because I felt like I had to fight for my rights and fight for my place all the time. So sorry, but
it's okay.
I did feel like I had to fight for my place all the time, but at the same time, we didn't get any like sexual harassment that was, you know, from any band members that we were touring with or anything like that. You know, the label would suggest really ridiculous things.
I can only imagine. The A&R vision.
Yeah, the A&R vision is just ridiculous.
And certain highly publicist suggestions for photo shoots and things like that.
Exactly. Highly offensive. Yeah. And I was in a different band with, which was all women, and that got it even worse. So because there was two women, because Elise was the manager, because both of us are pretty hardcore and can be really strong women. And we gave off that vibe, and we kind of told people to fuck off that suggested these kinds of things to us. We were okay, but it was, you know, it was a struggle. It was a battle. Absolutely. 100%. It's not that way anymore. I don't think people are much more open to women being in bands. It's not like, oh, you're the chick in the band. You know, there's not this novelty aspect that was so prevalent and frustrating. But yeah, we didn't get too harassed by, you know, anybody that we were touring with. Some of the stories that are coming out are just horrifying and sad.
Yeah, it's a bum out. Were you close with Gwen back in those times? Were you friends with her? And was her career trajectory something you kind of saw from a close vantage point? And obviously, I mean, what an amazing career and life she's made for herself, and obviously super talented, and that's where that comes from. But even if just No Doubt had kind of been all that she did, you'd still be like, wow, killed it, incredible. But then to go on and be like this kind of pop diva, R&B, hip hop sort of phenomenon as well, is pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. Elise, the other singer for Dancehall Crashers, Elise Rogers, grew up in Anaheim, so knew those guys very well because they're from Anaheim, from Orange County. So she was quite close with them. So we played with them a lot. We toured with them a little bit, played a lot of shows with them. And Gwen is a sweetheart. You know, I haven't seen her in person or talked to her in person for years, but at that time, she really was a total sweetheart. And
was it evident that she was kind of a star even early on?
Absolutely. Like the first time I saw her, you cannot take your eyes off her when she's performing. You're just like absolutely floored. She, you know, obviously she would run around across the stage, but just stunningly gorgeous, such a physical, beautiful presence, on stage and off, like off stage too. You just gotta take your eyes off her, but you know, she just incredible style, incredible creativity. You know, she was studied art for a little while. This is like always making her own clothes, absolutely, like from day one, doing, you know, amazing hairdos and just into the art of it and the creative aspect of it. And it was not surprising at all. You always knew she was going to be a star. No question. And then we played it was a funny series of about a year where they got signed to Interscope, we got signed, and we were sort of like, our career was starting to do better, and we ran into them on tour, and they were playing this shitty little bar, and they were really pissed off that their label was just letting them down. They're like, this sucks. And we were playing this really big venue comparatively. And I was still just kind of shocked, you know, like, she's going to be huge. Like, how is this happening? And then about 6 months later, we played a show with them in Petaluma, which is Northern California. And I'm Just a Girl was just starting to get on the radio, and they had this crazy group of girls following them, and this, you know, scene starting to happen. And they were taking off, and it was like they finally got what they needed from the label and from the sort of getting that song on the radio and K-Rock, which was a big deal. And they were just starting to take off, and it was like, oh yeah, here they go.
Yeah, what a tune as well. What an amazing song that is. On the flip side of that, a far more tragic outcome, Bradley and Sublime, were you close with those guys? Were you around them a lot? And what a tragic waste of talent that was, because, you know, what a phenomenal songwriter and artist he was too. Very different style, of course, but yeah, what a waste, what a sad loss.
Yeah, we played with them a lot also, actually, the three bands, No Doubt and Sublime and Dancehall Crashers, did quite a number of shows together.
That would be the bill, the three of you.
Yeah.
Wow.
There were quite a few of those.
Magic times.
Yeah. Yeah. It was incredible. And yeah, we were close with them. You know, they're a kind of challenging group of little hoodlums.
I've toured with Sublime with Rome, and what's the bassist called? Is it Eric?
Is it the same bass player?
It's the same bassist. Yeah. He's a wild man still.
Yeah. they were always like that. Which, you know, was just not our scene in that respect. But they were insanely talented, and they were on MCA, so that was another interesting thing, because I remember that MCA was like, there's no single on this album. This is the kind of shit we were dealing with, right? So they put the record out. The label was about to shelve it 100%, and they were shelving it because they said there was not one single on that album, and then Bradley died, and then they went, let's push everything we can. And of course, it was huge. So it just kind of goes to show you a little bit about what that sort of support or, you know, was or wasn't and how it worked. But Bradley was insanely talented. I mean, he was just phenomenal. It just, his voice alone is like incredible. Musicianship. Yeah. We did a lot with them for years.
I've heard live they could either be the best band you've ever seen or like the absolute worst as well, depending on the drug
depending
intake.
On how much drugs, yeah, how many drugs.
On the so night.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and they obviously, the thing that is often sort of overlooked, I guess, especially over here, because we don't know the full kind of history and backstory, but they did only get massive after he passed away, as you sort of alluded to there. So he never got to see any of the success of the band either, did he?
Not really. I mean, we were doing pretty good shows. I mean, we probably had, you know, 1,000, 1,200, 1,500 seaters before he passed. So we were doing pretty well. And we did a lot of festivals together. There were a lot of, you know, Long Beach Festival, all kinds of things, that Warped Tour, things like that, that were big crowds. So he did get some success, but not to the level that record just, you know, had hit after hit and became this kind of legendary, incredible, you know, piece of art and music that so many people associate with and so many people adored. And he never got to see that.
It is wild as well, because even to this day, you can walk into like any shop, store, bar in LA, and it's just sublime on loop still. It's like, it's in the air over there, isn't it? You step around any street corner or get in any car, and it's just like, love you. And what I got is just like, it's the anthem of the West Coast.
Yeah.
One of a few staples. But yeah, it's still so beloved, that music, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Powerful stuff. Powerful stuff.
Yeah.
So are you still friends with Elise? Are you guys still tight?
Yeah.
Are you close? You're on good terms? It's all positive?
Totally good terms. Everything's fine. We all live in different cities pretty much. So it's part of the challenge is, well, we don't really want to be doing it anymore everybody has their own individual reasons. I think some people would be fine to do it still. Other people don't really want to do it, but everybody's on good terms. We have a group text and group emails going and send funny things back and forth. It's totally fine.
Love it.
It was just time. It was time. We were together for 18. I was in the band for 18 years. I mean, I thought I was going to be in about 6 months because I had plans to move back to Europe, and then I didn't. And I was like, oh, look, 18 years just flown by.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Is your mum still with us? Is she still alive?
Yes, she is.
She is. Is she still living in America, or did she return to Czech Republic, or where she's still in the States as well? Is she?
Yeah, we moved here, and my mom and myself are still in the States, and the rest of my family's, you know, either in England or in France or in the Czech Republic. So,
did your parents approve of your burgeoning rock and roll career? Did they watch with pride and encouragement, being the kind of, you know, arty rebel loving kind of wild cards that they are? They were all about it, were they? They were behind you.
Absolutely, yeah. They never limited me, and were always very encouraging. And so I'm very fortunate to have had that. Absolutely. And my mom's whole side of the family are musicians. So in the Czech Republic. So my aunt's a singer. My uncle's a trombone player, and a lot of artists and, you know, theater. My grandfather was an actor and a play director and a radio director, and so the kind of performing arts on that side of the family is very strong. And then on my dad's side, not as much, but a little bit too. So they were all very encouraging of that. Yeah.
Love it. Have you connected much with Eugene from Gogo Bordello over the years?
No.
I reckon you two would get on like a house on fire, because he comes from a very similar background of academia and bohemia. And, you know, obviously he's from the Ukraine, not Czech, so slightly different part of Eastern Europe, but very similar stories of kind of these intellectual bohemian upbringings. And then, you know, obviously immigrating to America and falling into punk. And yeah, I think you two would get on really well. Mm. Very similar stories.
We've rarely crossed paths. Like, it's been a couple of times that we've been on shows, but not that much. So
you should grab him and say hello next time you're in the same orbit. And yeah, I think you definitely hit it off. So when, how, obviously you say you're playing shows back in the day with NOFX, were they always people that you were sort of close with, buddy with, or is it, you know, more kind of just like, hey, hello, fairly limited exchange? And then when do you get the offer to start, I guess, the records first, working on stuff with Mike? How does all that timeline pan out?
So we toured with them, you know, when I was in dance hall. We did a lot of, we did Warped Tour in Europe. We did just some touring opening for them, et cetera, et cetera. But then Dance Hall Crashers ended up being on Fat Records. So his record label under the Pink and Black moniker, which was a sort of part of the Fat Records labels, you know, series at that point, kind of mostly for female acts or female fronted acts. And so we went on to Pink and Black. We also released our old album on Honest Dawns. And I live in San Francisco. Most of us are pretty much Bay Area centric, except for Elise lives in, you know, was in LA, back in LA. But so I would party with them all the time.
Right. Of course.
That's how it works. So, you know, there were a lot of, Fat Records was down the street, and we would go to a lot of shows together, spend a lot of time with Mike and with Aaron.
Was Spike loads of fun when he was drinking?
Oh my God. He's still loads of fun. He doesn't actually need the alcohol to be loads of fun. So, yeah,
he's a wonderful man, but I bet he was a fun one to be around in those days. Yeah,
absolutely. Lots of karaoke, fun parties. So me and him would be leading the karaoke. Yeah,
amazing.
And all the Fat Records staff and crew, I'm still really good friends with in San Francisco. We just had a big reunion, and that was really fun.
We'll get to them, the recent shows. Yep. Yeah, can't wait to hear about them.
And, you know, Tony Sly, No Use for a Name. We toured with them a lot. NOFX did. Dance Hall Crashers did. So they were kind of hanging out a lot, because some of them lived, you know, they were living in California, Northern California, and Lagwagon, et cetera, et cetera. So everybody was, you know, either somewhere between, you know, San Francisco and LA, either in San Jose, and lots of hanging out and partying. So we were good friends, and they put out our albums, Dance Hall Crasher albums.
Again, what a golden time, you know, Fat's taking off, CD sales are flying, all those punk bands are getting signed up. Just
these were good.
Another magical golden era.
It really was, because, you know, we all got to take kind of control back of our own music in a really positive way, and have that, you know, that time that we could create our own thing, either through Fat Records or other people had their own way of doing it, but through smaller labels and Side One Dummy, we released stuff. There was all kinds of, you know, Epitaph. There were a lot of people putting out great things. So it was a magical time, actually. I think, you know, in retrospect, we didn't know that at the time, but it was a good scene. And so I spent a lot of time with them. I became close to all those guys. And then, you know, Mike had his recording studio here in San Francisco, Motor Studios, and I recorded on a bunch of their albums, like as a guest, and I would always guest on kind of a lot of Fat Records people. So No Use for a Name, Tony Sly's solo albums, High Standard, Limp, The Real McKenzies, you know, Spike's record. Like I did a lot of, like, there's a lot of guest spots that I kind of added little bits and was asked to do, invited to do.
I DJ'd a wedding over the weekend and a couple requested their last dance song. So they had the first dance and then the last dance song was the High Standard cover of Can't Help Falling in Love with You, which was a fun way to end it. And I just saw, what's the guy's name from Real McKenzies? Paul.
Okay.
What a character that man is. I actually did one of these with him, but I couldn't put it out because it was just like rambling nonsense. It was kind of amazing, but he basically just, it was on Zoom, but he had it on his phone and he was just like, it was just a one man kind of show. And I was like, it was really entertaining for me, but I was like, I don't think this is going to make sense as a podcast. So I didn't get to air it in the end, but I love him and what a force of nature he is.
Yeah. That's a nice way of putting it. No, he's brilliant. It's fun. Yeah,
he's
but
a berserker.
Then, yes, that's
and sober yeah. and sober. I imagine he wasn't always that way, but like, yeah.
Yeah, and then Mike was, you know, started working on the musical that he was writing, Home Sweet Home, among other kinds of projects here and there that he was doing. But Home Sweet Home, I was one of the main people that was coming in and, you know, helping him demo and write these songs. So he was writing them, but he would ask me to play different female characters vocally, singing these parts.
Is that you that's on a lot of the songs from that are out then?
Well, the early series I did, and then a lot of actors redid my parts. So my reflections, my ideas.
I've heard the versions you're on then, I think. And that material for me is some of the best, absolute best stuff Mike's ever written.
And you
do a fantastic job as well. And just the whole thing. What's the I'm Suicide? What's that song?
Oh, yeah, that's a hardcore one. See, a lot of these songs have changed so many times, so I don't even know which version you had been listening to, but that's what was happening. Is he was demoing them, they would, you know, they were writing the musical, it would change, they'd get a different producer maybe, or they would kind of change the storyline a little bit. That's what you do when you're writing something like that, right? So I was coming in and changing parts and changing characters. Okay, now do this same character, but let's make her from Brooklyn and let's make her like, you know. So I would sort of, and working with Mike is very specific, like he's incredibly detailed. And he'll sort of be like, okay, sing. And you're like, do you mean sing? Da, 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 da. And he'd be like, yeah, that. So like, you have to kind of like try to guess what he said. So I was doing a lot of that for him. And then he'll change like, no, change the third note. Da, 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 da. Okay, change it to this. Da, 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 da. You know, like he's very, very detailed. So
do you grow super close as people in that process and bond kind of in a very special and intimate way? Because I've spoken to you about this before. He speaks very highly of you and I can tell that he admires and respects you greatly. And working on someone like that in a situation like that must be a very special, intimate experience because of the nature of the material as well and how raw and intense some of it is. But creative and fun as well. It's quite a heady mix of stuff going on, isn't it?
Very dark. It's very kind of intense material. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think we had just had a really good rapport always. Obviously he's absolutely hilarious and I think he's really funny. So I don't know if everyone does, but I think he's particularly hilarious. So we have a lot of laughs. I do think we became very close. I think knowing each other that long for that many years and seeing all the stuff that we've both kind of gone through, you know, divorces and blah, 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 difficult times, good times, really hard times. I think you do become really close. Just, you know, we've always been very good friends kind of throughout this process, but I think that was a window of time that we got closer again as good friends. And that's how I ended up in NoFX, was the kind of long story short, is that when Limo was leaving, he left the band, and I'm good friends with Limo, who was the keyboard player for years. Limo also toured with Dancehall Crashers. He was one of our techs for a little while, and so was Jay Walker, and so was Kent. So, like, I'm, you know, was very involved with all of them, and the scene. We're all good friends. So once Limo was leaving NoFX, Mike just like called me up kind of in the middle of the night, actually. He was like, "Oh my God, you should join. You should be our keyboard player," because I had been working with him on the musical. So sometimes I'd be like, no, it's this chord you want to play. Isn't it this chord or this chord? And he'd seen my band around town, because I write my originals, and he would come see my bands. So he knew that I had these other abilities, you know, like, let's kind of sing it jazzy. Let's sing it this way. Let's kind of do your jazzy blues thing that you do, and, you know, that kind of thing. And I'd already sang on a bunch of the albums, on Mattersville, I'm an Alcoholic, all these, like, you know, other NoFX songs, but also Fat Records songs. So that's kind of how it ended up.
He's like, "Can I just say as well, you absolutely elevate the Frank Turner split. I think that's some of the best NoFX stuff in years. Ironically, it's not, you know, Mike's compositions, yes, but because for me, you and Hefe are both so talented and great and so underused in more recent years. But that record, I got to hear both you really do your thing and be front and center. And yeah, I think they're some of my favorite NoFX recordings ever, those Frank Turner covers, and you're brilliant on them.
Thank you so much.
There Really Is No God. That one is just so good.
I know. I think that was the one that Mike's like, just go for it. Like, sing your thing, that, you know, just make it really bluesy. And I was like, well, this is kind of almost like pushing it to like cheesy, you know, soul singer. You really want that? And he's like, go all the way. He really wanted me to just go for it. I was like, okay, I can do those licks. If you want me to do it, I'll do it.
No,
it's like,
it's
not
awesome.
Really what you normally want. You really want usually a punk kind of voice. So anyway, that's how I ended up in the band.
Well, kind cheers to that.
Cheers.
Have a cup of tea. Just water at the moment. So what era, 2016 is when you start touring with them. So what's going on around that time? Is that like that first ditch effort, or is that before then?
No, it was way after that.
Way after.
Oh, no, first ditch effort. Sorry, I thought you said, sorry, something else. It is first ditch effort. So I was on that album.
And is the touring side of
2017,
things?
I think First Ditch Effort, did it come out in 2017 or did it come out in 2016? And then I had recorded but hadn't started touring with them. I think it was 2017 that it came out.
But it's around that time.
Yeah.
And what's the mood in the camp around then when you join? Where's NoFX at then? What you can tell me.
I mean, I have a bad memory of things sometimes, but I feel like it was still really positive. It's not super negative now. I think that, yeah, things were going great. I mean, Kent was doing it. Kent took a break probably 2018 to, can't remember exactly what years, but there was a couple of years that he wasn't touring with us. But at that point, everybody was doing great and getting along great. I think they had just taken a little time from touring, like a little mini break. You know, sometimes they did that over the 40 years they've been together.
Yeah.
They would take like 6 months off or do kind of a slow year just to give themselves a break, that kind of thing.
Well, 60%, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It's funny
why overdo it?
It's funny how true that song really is.
It's brilliant. It's so on the money. And why not? And why not? I love it. So when, just sort of jumping around real quickly, but in Austria, I thought that show was so good, And everyone was like, oh, you know, complaining because Mike didn't sing. And it's like, well, there's two options in a situation like that. Either they cancel and let everybody down, or they just do what NoFX do and just go, well, let's just give them what NoFX do, which is NoFX show. Melvin stepped up, and I thought that was one of my favorite NoFX shows I've ever seen because it was different. Watching Mike liberated from vocal duties freed him up as a performer, and he's running around like a madman. It was a really special, fun show. But I find it funny because we live in this different time now with social media and like online criticism. The negative stuff rises to the top always. But it's so funny to me that a fan of NoFX would criticize NoFX for being NoFX and doing exactly what the, it's like that you can't open your set with a song like 60% and be like, this is our mission statement, this is how we roll, I'm not here to entertain you, et cetera, et cetera. And then they go, oh, those guys don't give a shit. And it's like, well, they've kind of been saying they don't give a shit all along.
Yeah. Yeah. Newsflash, listen to the fucking lyrics, dum-dum. I know, it's. I agree. I absolutely agree. That whole thing was, you know, Mike was really on the fence about playing some of those shows that we did on that trip when he lost his voice. He really didn't want to do a couple of shows. And we all talked him into it. Because we were like, what are we going to do? Not play? And all these people, you know, people had flown from Brazil and Australia. Like, what are we going to just not play at all? Like, you have three or four singers in the band that can cover, you know, it's not going to be perfect. It's going to be sloppy.
I mean, it's never perfect. Let's be honest.
Yeah, let's be real.
Perfection is not what we want.
And I mean, to the point where like, they were like, Karina, you go sing Champs-Élysées. And I was like, what are you talking about? It's in French. I only know like part of the verse. I don't know the whole song because I don't usually sing the whole song. And they're like, just go out and sing it. And I was like, what are you talking? And literally on stage, they're like, just do it. And I was like, what? It's in French. Like if it was in English, I wouldn't be able to. It's like, I know part of it, but I don't know the whole song. It was ridiculous. So I just handed this, you know, the mic out to the audience, like, right, you're a bunch of Frenchies here. Someone speaks French here because we're in Austria. I'll just do the parts I know. No, so, you know, that's part of NoFX is it's like, it is 60%. There is an element of like, things are always very unpredictable. And what I love about them is that every single show, and I noticed this when Dancehall Crashers toured with them, their comedy is different every night. It's not repeated.
There's no script. And that's why sometimes, again, we won't go too much into this, but sometimes a joke will perhaps push the boundaries of taste and decency, but it's because it's not preordained. And it just, in the moment, sometimes we say stuff and then we go, I mean, they probably didn't think, oh, that was a bit much, but then all it takes is one person to go, that was too much for me. And it becomes this, but it's in situations like that, for better or worse, that you really realize that, oh, these guys aren't reading off a script. This is just off the cuff, in the moment. Anything can happen.
Yeah, and it's constant comedy backstage on the bus anyway. So it's like they're flexing that muscle all the time so that when they're on stage, it comes back out, you know, as a performer. But you know, back to the Austrian show, that was a rough night for all of us. Me and Hefe also were really sick. I don't know if you remember this, but I talked to you after the show. And I think you said hi to me before. And I was like just not like responsive because I got really sick. So Mike had lost his voice. Melvin had already covered for him for like one or two days. So he was starting to lose his voice because he was just kind of trying to keep it together. And then Hefe and I went to the doctor that morning, both had like some crazy throat infection that was like we had gotten something from somebody, like some kind of strep throat or something. So we both were on hardcore antibiotics that morning and we were trying to keep it together. We're like, what is going on? Like, we're all getting sick. So whatever Mike had probably gave it to us. So we were all really sick. Like different, whatever. And I wasn't COVID, but we were all just like, ugh. What were we going to do? Not play the show? I mean, you know, the show must go on. They say that for a reason. You have to give the people that are there something, right? Try.
I absolutely loved it. I thought you were all fantastic and really rose to the occasion. And I think what's funny, And I'm not throwing any other bands under the bus here, but it was really interesting to me the next day, without mentioning names, because the festival continued for 2 days after NoFX had gone on.
Right.
And all these other bands are coming in and they're getting wind, like, oh, Mike didn't sing last night. It was a really shit show. And they're just seeing what was on the internet, right? And I'm like, no, it was a fucking awesome show. It was a NoFX show. And it was just, to me, it was interesting that, and I could see the bands were like, oh, how did NoFX get away with that shit? And it's like, I can see, and sometimes often it comes from a good place, but you can see that other bands get envious and jealous of the fact that NoFX can phone it in and people still go, it's fucking awesome. Because they're like, if we did that, everybody would just say we're shit. And it's like, yeah, but you know, you ain't NoFX, dude. Because they've set that stall up since day one.
That's right. They set it up. They also, because they don't take themselves too seriously overall, and it is, yeah, exactly. They've set it up. They've, you know, they've given you the information that you can either take it in and know that's what you might get one of those kind of shows or not. But you know, everyone tries really hard and everyone's a great musician. It's just unpredictable anyway. I mean, you don't know what you're going to get when you get on stage. It's like, I can feel like really good, really like I got enough sleep. I'm all like juiced. I'm like not hungover, whatever. I feel like, yes, let's do this. I feel strong. And you get on stage and you just have a shit show. And then another time you'll feel like I didn't get any sleep. I've been, you know, I feel like crap. It's been like 3 days of no good, you know, no sleep, and I feel like shit. And you go on stage and you have a great show. You don't really know. In that situation, obviously Mike was really ill, but we all were, and we just all kind of tried to pull it together. It was a rough night for everybody as far as how we felt, but you know, you had to do what you had to do. I think that playing is better than canceling.
100%. And on the flip side of that, the three nights in Barcelona was absolute magic every night. I was so grateful to be out there for all of that, and just like the amount of photos that I got over those three nights, and in Austria as well. I've got like, I had 1800 altogether from those four shows, which I whittled down to like 300, just solid gold, incredible photos. And I, even at that point, was like, none of these even are really like worth deleting because they're all so good and there's so many. And those three nights in Barcelona, they felt like there was real magic in the air that night, especially the first and the last night. But all of them were just like amazing.
Agreed. They were so fantastic. I mean, our joke after that series was like, let's only play first shows and third shows and not ever play a second show.
Yeah. Well, it's hard, isn't it? Because you come in with that first night energy and then you've got the last night energy, and it really is just the sandwich filling in the middle of the second show, isn't it? It's like, what can you do with that show apart from like try and keep the energy of the first going? But it's a tough one. Because when you do two shows, the second night's never like worse than the first. But that three in a row is kind of a weird.
Yeah.
If you're going to any of these shows and there's three in a row, pick night one or three, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, also because we were doing different albums each night, you know, that's what makes it really hard. And I think the second night, it just depends on the set list. We're doing different set lists. Even if we do, you know, obviously some of the same albums.
Yep.
Obviously, we're doing different set lists every night. Every night that we're playing on this final tour is different in one way. You know, it'll be some different songs, some songs deleted, some songs added from different albums.
And just as musicians, to be able to be in a position to play all of these different variations of so many songs proves how good all of the band is.
Everybody's a badass. Everybody in the band is a badass, you know. We may or may not have a perfect show of actual playing, but there'll be some really good jokes there. So.
And I think with that second Barcelona show, there was quite a few Samba songs, which I loved, and I liked those moments. But I think that was what maybe sucked some of the energy down a bit, is there was a lot of like the mic and the kind of, you know, so I don't know whether he plays acoustic guitar, but just like him and a guitar, you know, the Whoops I OD'd and songs like that, that are very much kind of like, you know, downbeat. So that obviously affects it. And weirdly, you touched on something a moment ago. I tour a lot and DJ between bands when I go out on the road. And I notice during the changeovers, a lot of the kind of energy in the rooms and how that can differ. And sometimes you can roll into a town and put on a better show than you put on in the previous city, but the crowd's just not with you. Because half of it is them, like, at least.
Absolutely.
And some nights I've seen bands go out and just lay their fucking heart on the line and leave everything on stage, and the crowd's just like unfazed, and you're like, what the fuck happened there? And you just never
100%.
know.
100%. And I think maybe even in Barcelona there was a little bit of that, because some people came in for the three shows. They went crazy for the first show. They were hungover and tired for the second show. And then they third show, they were like, yes, it's the last.
Pull it back. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, as a performer, you know, especially, you know, I sing lead in most of the other groups I'm in, obviously. I'm in quite a few bands. So, but, you know, I often come on stage, you know, thinking, okay, like, you have to kind of feel the energy of the room, you know, you have to you kind of get a sense of what the vibe is and how people are feeling, if they're too hot, if they're excited, if they're, you know, like, where they are, you know, and you kind of have to read the room a little bit, or the festival field or whatever, and try to potentially transform that if you need to, but you can't always do it. And you don't, you know, like, sometimes you do, sometimes you're able to go, oh, they feel a bit tired, let's like bring it up. But other times you can't. And so there is this kind of funny, that's why live performance is so interesting. It's not, you're not going to get the same thing, right? It's as a performer, it's a strange moment of feeling truly alive that you can't. That's why I think everyone becomes drug addicts and alcoholics, because you're constantly searching for that same high that you get, you know, when you're on stage, which is this very alert, you know, heightened sense of reality. And if you can't turn around the room or the field wherever you are, it's frustrating. And maybe you finally get it, you do it, and you can't. But I'm sure the same thing happens as a DJ. It's like you've got a bunch of sort of strange dead feeling or energy in the room, or whatever, not dead, but just low. You sometimes you can turn it around and sometimes you really can't.
I remember when I was a little bit earlier on in the kind of evolution of my career, and I would go out and do sets between bands and the crowd would be lifeless, and I used to take it really personally, like I'd failed. But then I'd see the headline act go out and people had come to see them and they'd paid to see them, and they were still, you know, like a piece of dead wood. Yeah. And I was like, ah, some people are just bum out. And you can't, it's so interesting. Everything you touch on there, it fascinates me. And it really is. It's the stuff of life for me, being up on stage. I host a lot of live Q&As as well. And that's a really raw form of energy manipulation and trying to like read the room and gauge the energy levels and work with it. And it's the most fascinating element of live entertainment for me, and it's something that I think will never stop capturing my imagination and my interest and my drive. It's just, and it, as you say, there's never ever two shows that are exactly the same ever.
No, it can be the same set, it can be the same room, you just don't know what you're going to get. And you know, everything that you just mentioned, you don't even city to city, you know, New Yorkers are very different from San Francisco audiences, you know, whoever else is in the crowd, you know, on three different nights in Barcelona, like I said, if they were tired the second night too, we were tired, but they were also tired. So there might be these kinds of, you know, same city or just different city vibes that are very transformative and really change how it feels. And you can't be 100%, you know. I mean, I messed up on something the other day in Florida that I've never messed up. It's like, how, you know, like, why would I mess up that one part? I've never messed that up. And that kind of stuff happens, you know. You're like, you know, you get this sort of look from somebody in the band, like, and you're like, I know the part. Why did I mess? I don't know why I fucked that up. I did it right the last like 300 times, but today I just didn't do it right. I don't know why that happened. You know, you can't help it.
I host monster truck shows, and that happens occasionally to me when doing them, is you're so dialed in with the script and you're so rehearsed, and the easiest thing that you've done 100 times, you fuck up once and you're like, what, how? And they're sort of they're on the comms on the ears, like, how did you blow that? Like, you're like straight out the gate, like the first thing or something. And you're like, oh man, it's so, I think because you've got so much in your head, sometimes like the tiniest thing can seep through the hole. And then you're just like, oh yeah. And then, but it reminds you like to be on your game. And it's
absolutely
a really cool like awakening. And you're like, oh yeah, I can't take this shit for granted and think that I've got this all dialed in, because stuff like that can happen and remind me that, you know, always pay attention.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So how was San Francisco? Some of the footage and the photos I saw from that show just looked glorious. Obviously, you alluded earlier on to the history of Fat and, you know, so many of these bands and these personalities. San Francisco was home base for so much of it. So there must have been so many friends and old familiar faces. And yeah, was it special? Was it incredible?
It was, actually. It felt like those Barcelona shows that you were mentioning. Excuse me. It felt extremely special. It did have, and the backstage was ridiculous, because it, like, you know, I mean, I had a million friends there myself.
Well, that was the thing with Barcelona, real quickly, sorry, is there weren't guests there, really. You know, there was obviously like the people that you have on stage. There always are at NoFX shows, but I didn't notice there was like a ton of friends of the band and stuff at that one. So to have, you know, all of the people who are on stage on the NoFX show anyway, and then 200 or probably more close friends of the band and everybody in it.
I mean, I think the NoFX backstage guest list was about 300 and 350, but that's not including every other band that had backstage passes for their guests, or Fat Records, which had its own guest list. So we're talking about, like, I don't know, maybe 600 people backstage. I don't know, 500. It was mad. And it was mad. And the show itself, it was, I think, about 10,000 people there. We got really good weather, things that matter, right? Because San Francisco is very cold usually. So that was, it was just a lovely evening. It was really fun. It was really epic. I think the set list was great. It was really good vibes and energy within the band. Everybody played well. We had a good show. We had a really good
show.
Was
it just the one night?
Just the one night.
Yeah, perfect. So in and out, job done. I mean, you wouldn't want two nights on the bounce with a crowd like that, would you? 600 guests. Like, no guests for night two.
Yeah. I mean, we could do, you know, if we did three shows, I would say, you know, we'd have one show one and show three. But
yeah.
We wouldn't do a second show. We would just do one.
And loads of guests on stage, I imagine. Was there a lot of guest appearances?
That's crazy.
Playing
on
and
stage.
Guests.
Yeah. The decline was ridiculous. It was pretty funny in rehearsal. You know, Mike turns to me and's like, we're going to have like, you know, 10 or 15 guitarists at the end of the decline come up. And Rugley, our guitar tech's like, excuse me, what? Don't tell her, tell me. What are you talking about? It'd be good to tell me. And so me and Mike are just continue joking about it. I'm like, great, I'm glad I know. Thanks for letting me know. I'll be on that. Rugley's like, hello, what? So yeah, we had a ridiculous amount of guests. We had Jack from the Swinging Utters, and we had lots of people. It was really fun, super fun.
And how is Florida? What's the NoFX Florida relationship like?
Well, a lot of people came from a lot of other places. Florida, you know, Florida is its own special little sweaty state of hell.
Florida gets a bad rap, doesn't it?
Well,
is it justifiably so?
Have you ever seen that TV show Cops?
No.
Bad boys, what you gonna do? Basically, it's all about like cops busting people for, you know, I don't know, doing terrible things, of course, lots of drug addicted
crocodiles, things like this, roaming the streets.
Essentially. But it's not, so it's not supposedly shot in Florida, but basically 90% of the
I mean, I guess the thing that comes to mind for me is the Tiger King.
There you go. No, I'm being really mean now. Everyone from Florida's going to hate me. I actually do personally love Florida, but it's funny. It gets a bad rap in the States. So it was great. It was a really fun show. It was really hot and sweaty. So we were all a bit like suffering. I got I got bug bites all over my ankles from like weird bugs that are gnats everywhere. But it was an excellent show. Circle Jerks, Lesson Jake, it was just a really fun vibes. And a lot of good friends came out again because people flew from different places, people from Brazil, and a lot of friends on stage, a big, fun Decline jam session at the end as well.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, it was really fun.
So emotions obviously run high. Has it been like that pretty much every night by the end? Like tears from Mike, and Hefe's been crying a lot in the ones that I've seen. Melvin and Smelly seem to keep it together a little bit more at this stage. Maybe that'll change as the shows get closer to that final one. But I mean, what's it like after the shows are finished? And there's just that absolute, I guess, void of energy and adrenaline and emotion because you've left it all up there. It must be like quite a charged, heightened, special in its own way vibe every night when you come off stage together.
Yeah, I feel like the shows have been up and down when it comes to emotion. I know that for myself, you know, those Barcelona shows, for example, I was getting really teary. And then certain cities will do that to me. I don't even feel like I got pretty teary, I think, in San Francisco. Florida, I didn't. And it's not because it's Florida. It's not because it's Orlando. It's because part of it is just like, maybe that for me, since we're still playing, it doesn't really feel like the end. I can't really, sometimes I can take that in and really feel it. And other times it just is like, oh, it's just a show. So, you know, you're still got all that kind of hyped energy and it doesn't feel like the end. So I kind of can't quite believe it, you know?
I guess you've only got a certain amount of bandwidth, right, to give. You can't be up there every night going, you know, sometimes yeah. You got to hold a little back to get through your life.
Absolutely. And, you know, if we end with something like Kill All the White Man, it's like, I'm not going to start crying on that one because it's hilarious. So, I mean, I'm just saying you don't always get like certain songs, maybe Decline and Theme will sort of take you there a little bit more. Maybe that might be a thing too. Backstage after the show, I feel like we get spread out pretty far. Like people kind of like everybody's clamoring on to different band members to kind of want to talk to them. And, you know, we all tend to have some friends or family there, even if they're extended family or whatever. So you kind of end up getting a little bit drawn into that, you know, or hanging out with your buddies or other band members. So I don't feel like there's this collective moment where after the show we're all together. We don't tend to have that.
Do you think you'll have that at the last one? Do you think you'll do it? Is it something that's been spoken about? Because I mean, God knows how many guests will be at that one, 1,000 probably, but
that'll be a nightmare. I don't think we're going to get that moment. I don't think we'll have that. I mean, we have those moments when we're all, you know, in a van together that we all got picked up or in a bus together in Europe or something. And that's when we have those moments where there's no other fans or no other family or no other, you know, wives or husbands or boyfriends. And we have kind of, you know, it's just the small group. And then we kind of get more connected. I would say that's the time, you know, we'll go out, get some food together somewhere, you know, that kind of thing. We don't tend to have that at shows. It's just too crazy.
Yeah. Well, they're the beautiful moments really, aren't they? They define, I think the whole story is those little moments, the downbeats. That's absolutely when those real connective memories, I think, are forged. And when you look back on it, you'll be like, oh, you know, it's like when a relationship comes to an end, right? It's for me, when I walk around supermarkets, I always think about my ex because I used to really enjoy just going around and food shopping with her because it was such a simple, like wholesome thing that it brought me a lot of joy. And whenever now I'm in the supermarket in Camden near where she used to live, and we broke up 6 years ago, this is ages ago, I walk around there sometimes because I DJ at a bar opposite it a lot. And I'll be like, oh man, I get all like emotional. And it's like, what? I'm in a supermarket. Don't break down now. In the frozen section, like.
Frozen peas. Fish fingers.
Got to get a grip, Matt. You got to get a grip. So here's a little bit of news. I will be in Australia for all of those shows, hopefully. I mean, I'm going to be there at that point. I'm going to try and make it to as many as many of them as possible. I've actually pitched to Kent to try and get on the shows doing some DJing between bands. So we'll see if that comes off. But either way, I will endeavor to be there because I'm going to do a tour in November. I was going to stay on a few weeks after that tour and then come home for Christmas. But then I saw that NOFX were announcing those shows in January. I was like, fuck it. I'm going to stay in Australia for 3 months and I'm booking a bunch of Q&A and DJ gigs in the lead up to when you guys come over to sort of tide me over. And yeah, I'm just going to ride
for 3 months.
3 months. I've just moved out. I'm at my dad's house at the moment. I've just moved out of my house in Bristol, packed up my life. I go on tour in the UK for a month, go on the Flogging Molly cruise and then over to Australia. And so I've got so much stuff backed up and I was like, I've got no reason to return. I've got nothing here that I need to be here for. I can work from anywhere as long as I can get a few gigs. So, and I'm going to go and write my third book down there and kind of treat it as like a writer's retreat. So yeah, 3 months in Australia, ending with the NOFX tour, and then I'll fly back after they're done. So
brilliant.
They'll be amazing. NOFX in Australia. Yeah. I mean, Aussies are just the best, aren't they? Best people.
Yeah.
Most fun.
It's pretty great. Also, just as an English person, the first time I went to Australia, I was like, this is great. It's like the best combination of England and the States. It's like you can get beans on toast, a good cup of tea, you know.
Sausage rolls, stuff like
sausage
that.
Sausage rolls, exactly. Marmite instead of Vegemite. But hey, Vegemite. But then, it, you know, it feels like tropical and like you're in the States or something. Yeah, so that'd be brilliant. That'll be so fun.
Yeah, I can't wait to catch up with you again. So listen, I'll let you go in a moment because I've kept you for long enough already and I appreciate your time. And it's lovely to hear your stories and learn more about you and your life. Before I let you go, I want to get into some of your own work and where people can kind of find some of the, you know, the most, I guess, insightful moments that really showcase who you are as a songwriter and an artist, because, you know, I've heard sprinklings in NOFX over the years and getting to kind of explore the Dancehall Crashes stuff. I feel like I know your, you know, voice a little bit better now, but I feel like there's so much more still to explore and I'm excited to delve in. So where do I and other people start, you know, getting to grips with Karina as a, you know, a solo artist and a, you know, a band leader? Oh, I've lost you. The connection.
Am I
I think it's just a bad connection. Hold on, we'll get you back. You are there. There's just a slight lag.
Can you hear me now? Is it still lagging?
There we go. I think we're
Hello.
We've caught up.
Hello.
Have you got me?
Well, I have yes, I've got. It does say it's unstable. Let me just make sure that it shouldn't be.
You're unstable,
Karina.
Can
you hear me okay?
I asked you to tell me about your music, and you've gone unstable on me.
I know. Can you hear? Is it okay now?
Talk a little bit more. It seems to still
hello.
Yeah.
Weird.
There's a very slight.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have a website that's just my name.com, www.karinadanike.com. And then I also sell my music on Bandcamp. So that's another way just to kind of download my album and find out other new things that are kind of coming down the pipeline. I've got a few things in the works. I haven't talked too much about it because I didn't want to talk about it and then have it not be perfectly ready to go. So there are some things that I'll be releasing. Some YouTube videos, of course, are always out there of different things that I've done that maybe aren't on my website and aren't on my Bandcamp is karinadanike.bandcamp.com.
I'll link that and the website to the episode description so people can,
brilliant.
Can get them there.
Yeah, that's some of the music that I write and some of the projects that I do that are separate from NOFX. And
what sort of world does that sit in terms of like who the comparative artists might be? If you were to say it sounds a little bit like this for fans of this, it's influenced by this. Because it's not punk rock, right?
Not at all.
Yeah, great.
Not at all. It's a little bit, you've got a little bit of like 20s, 30s era
That's my jam. So, yeah. I mean, for me, one of my favorite TV soundtracks ever is Boardwalk Empire. Right. And that is all of that stuff, that prohibition swing. Like, right. Love that stuff. Love that stuff.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of that. There's a song called Boxing Glove, a song called Musée Mécanique on my album that kind of harkens to that time period, 20s, 30s, exactly Boardwalk Empire, kind of swing era, Fats Waller, people like that. Then it goes into a little bit of doo-wop on a song called You're So Quiet, which has some of the Hepcat guys singing on there with me. And then we go into a little bit more 50s, 60s rock and roll. And then we go into a little bit of 80s and spaghetti western. So it's a little bit all over the place.
Well, that just sounds, aside from punk, which I love, that sounds like all of my favorite music. And I'm not just saying that, like, that is pretty much my wheelhouse of absolute favorite stuff right there. Doo-wop, 50s rock and roll, spaghetti western, 80s new wave, and 20s swing.
Yeah, it's all in. It's none of the, yeah, no 70s. It's just 20s, 40s, 60s, 80s. And a little bit of like kind of sea shanty kind of stuff in there too. There's a little bit of it. Yeah. I know it's quite varied, but yeah. Check it out and then you'll know, because it's, each song has its own little flavor. So.
Well, I'm sold.
All right. Good.
Good. Job done. Only took us 90 minutes.
I know.
Just plug my record, Matt. Now, I never really do the plugs. That's not really what this show is about. It's about sharing stories and connecting and getting to know the guests better. And yeah, I'm really grateful for the times we've got to share out there in the live environment. And this was wonderful. And yeah, I will see you in a few months in the Southern Hemisphere. It will be our winter times, but it will be their summer. So it will be peak sunshine weather. And yeah, you got two nights in Sydney, Brisbane, and Melbourne, so bring it on. This year though, right? For No Effects, they're done for 2023. No more live shows. Yep,
so that'll be the first series after a little break, and hopefully at that point we won't all be sick like we were in Linz, because that was a rough night for us. But you know, as you said, fuck them. We did our best that night.
Well, you didn't do your best, but you put in a 60% effort, and that is more than enough.
That is our best.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
That's as high as we go, people.
Yeah, we don't really go any higher.
Karina, you're a star. Okay. Thank you so much for your time. And yeah, have a wonderful week. I'll let you know when this is going up, and we'll talk very soon.
Excellent. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.